And welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tocchini. This is our Legends Storyteller Series. And our very special guest today is my friend, Brad Moore, former executive of Hallmark Entertaining and brand manager at P&G, where he led Folgers. Brad, welcome to our show. Let's start with your backstory, reflecting on how your core values were learned from the great region of the Midwest.
I grew up in Illinois. Just south of Chicago, about 50 miles south of Chicago, went to public schools, went back to undergraduate school in Oklahoma to a school that's now called Southern Nazarene University. At that time, it was called Bethany Nazarene College. And my parents and grandparents had gone there, and my kids have subsequently gone there. It's a really terrific institution. And after that, I got my MBA at Northwestern University in Chicago. And from there, went to Procter & Gamble.
So tell us how you were positively influenced by your parents and grandparents.
Both my grandfather and my father were ministers. And my father subsequently became a university president, and twice, as a matter of fact. And I would have to say he's an absolutely huge influence in my life, along with my mother, who was a pretty remarkable woman.
So, Brad, how did you integrate your personal values with the core values at Procter & Gamble?
You know, it turned out that I fit P&G really well when I got there. For whatever reason, people that really succeed at P&G, when I began to recruit for P&G, and I recruited at Syracuse University and at Harvard University, and we'd go and work with these MBA candidates, and I boiled it down very quickly to it was pretty much an instinctive decision in hiring people. And then later you go back and you rationalize it. You write up your notes and you make it, when I say rationalize, you make it rational. You have an instinctive decision. But it always boiled down to two or three things for me. One was, do you trust this person? Could you really trust this person? Are they going to always tell the truth and try to do what's right? And the next factor was, do they work really hard? Are they hardworking people? And you can glean that from interviews, I think, especially if you push for examples in their lives. And are they smart? Are they smart people? And I don't necessarily mean academically, but just good common sense street smart people. And if you can trust somebody and they work really hard and they're smart, you know, you want to hire them. And my conclusion was that P&G had been hiring people using those kind of criteria, maybe not described exactly that way, but you know, for a long time. And When I interviewed there, it's kind of funny. I interviewed at Procter & Gamble out of grad school because I had a suit on that day, and I hadn't signed up on the P&G roster, and one of my friends said, hey, there's an opening. I said, well, I could use that as a good practice. So I went in to a practice interview and ended up being invited, you know, to the company for follow-up interviews. I think I kind of caught them a little off guard, because everybody who interviewed at Procter in those days was, they were just really on their best behavior and kind of begging. And I was a little ill prepared. So my tack was to say, well, why in the world do people want to work at Procter & Gamble? And I don't think why would you think I would want to work there? And I didn't ask it in an arrogant way, but I don't think they were, you know, got that question very often. And I asked him what they admired most about the company and why. And long story short, when I had a decision to make on where to go, because I at least had a couple of offers, I made my decision based on the people. I just decided that the people I had met at P&G in the whole interview process were the favorite people that I had met in the interview process. And I thought I would probably work long hours and be around other people at P&G a lot. And my thinking was that you know, when you join an organization or you become part of a particular culture or subculture, which is what you do when you join a company, especially if you think you're going to be there long term, my thought was that I'll become more like, you know, it will shape me and I'll become like the people I'm around. And I decided to accept P&G's offers because I thought, you know, these are the people I want to be like. So that's what, and it turned out I fit pretty well. And, cause I work really hard, work long hours. I was always very in college and every place else. I was always very thorough and pretty disciplined. Well, maybe not disciplined, but I was pretty thorough. And, sometimes I was more thorough than the other, than people I reported to, which is pretty remarkable at P&G. It's a company that's known for thoroughness. And, I think I could out thorough the other people. So I, you know, once I got there, I just felt like I fit really well. Just touched on value system. The other thing about P&G that I thought I fit was I was no one ever dreamed of asking me to do anything that I felt was in any way going to compromise my values. Mm-hmm. And it's a company that believes in the right things and doing what's right and doing what's honest and doing what's right for other people. And I've had the privilege of being in two companies like that. So I felt I fit from a value standpoint as well.
So tell us about one of your leadership roles at Procter and those accomplishments and how you leverage those accomplishments into Hallmark.
I was in the coffee division. The company had bought Folgers Coffee in the early 60s, 1963, I believe.
Yes.
And I joined the company in 1972 and had lived in Kansas City at one point. And when they asked if there was any particular division that I might prefer any products, I said nothing about the products, but I've lived in Kansas City and I know that you have a division there and I like that city. And I think they thought, well, we got a live one here. This guy's from the farm because the center of the world is Cincinnati. Everybody knows that. And so I was sent out to, they said, well, then let's have you interview in the coffee division. I spent 8 years there and it was really a wonderful time. And it was being able to see both a company that had been a family-owned company, incredibly successful, really well-run, but run kind of from the seat of the pants for the most part. And then it was being, the word they used was being Procterized. And I showed up, 9 years into that and, got to work with the people, the old timers there in the sales force and the other people that really knew the coffee business, as well as the people that were being infused there over the years from Procter & Gamble. And P&G was very careful how they did that. But then we moved the whole coffee division at one point to Cincinnati, everything except the manufacturing. And a little bit later, I became what was at that point called an associate advertising manager. I'd been a brand manager on two or three brands and became an associate, which is kind of a category manager position these days. I guess that's what it would be today, or a marketing director position. I think that's the current terminology. And that's the position I'll just talk to you about. It was for a year in that position in what was called PS&D at the time, packaged soap and detergent. It's kind of the grandfather division of the company. And here's this guy from the coffee division that it was the first time anybody had been promoted to a higher level in PS&D from coffee, that's for sure. So I was kind of a strange character showed up, and I had a variety of brands, and then we decided to put all of the dishwashing liquids under one person, under me. And prior to that time, they had been, if there were four associate ad managers and there were four brand managers on liquid detergent for dishwashing, they would each report to a different associate advertising manager. In other words, they kept the brands competitive with one another, one layer higher in the organization. And decided I was told I was the first category manager at P&G because all the dishwashing liquid then came under me. And it was a really very interesting experience on how to keep those products both competitive with one another, but also coordinated in a way that a brand called Sunlight that was coming in from the UK, as a matter of fact, how do we defend our turf against that brand? And so how do you coordinate brands at the same time as keeping them competitive? And it was, probably one of the most interesting assignments I had, with the exception of one in the coffee division when we were trying to become a beverage division. And for 6 months, I got a special assignment with just myself and a secretary and a pencil and a piece of paper. And it was, figure out how many gallons of liquid human beings take in every year, and how can we get the biggest share of liquid that human beings take in. We looked at bottled water, we looked at filtered water, we looked at everything except alcohol. And it was that was a fascinating assignment too.
So tell us about the life of a category leader over four competing brands.
One is called Ivory Liquid, and at the time it was the largest dishwashing liquid brand. Another was Dawn. Another was Joy, which and each of them had a very distinctive positioning. Ivory Liquid was mild to your hands, and it also had a value positioning. Dawn, to this very day, it takes grease out of the way. It's an incredibly good grease fighter. And Joy was the one that left your dishes sparkling and shiny. And I think the ad tagline was, "Isn't that a nice reflection on you?" And you always saw the mom's face reflected in the plate. And there was a test market brand called Cinch that had little scrubbers in it, a little bit of grit. And so we actually had those four brands split between four different, not only four different brand managers, but all their bosses, the brand manager's bosses, the associate advertising managers were different.
Tell us about the emotional connectivity of those brands to consumers.
Oh, it's strong. I learned that not only in that category, but in the coffee category, any food category, something that you ingest, that you actually eat and you take in, there's an emotional connection there. And especially coffee. Coffee is it's a kind of a social expression product. You drink coffee to perk yourself up. You drink coffee to calm yourself down, even coffee with caffeine. You drink coffee to socialize. So it turns out the coffee business wasn't all that different for me than the greeting card business. It's a very emotional product. There are other emotional products too in the food category, but that's something I'll point out to you. In my current role here at Hallmark, we really believe in the power of a brand, and that's a similarity with Procter & Gamble. There's a company that believes in the power of brands and what the loyalty and the esteem that a consumer will have for a brand, how they come to rely on a brand. I think the companies have that in common, and probably that drew me to Hallmark as well. And it's something that I probably had an instinct for when I went to Procter & Gamble. I wouldn't have wanted to work for a company that didn't have tremendous reputation and, let's call it, brand awareness and brand esteem in the products that it sold. I don't think I would have. There was no appeal to me personally for like an industrial product company that, really had no awareness, consumer. So I was drawn to brands at the very beginning. The places that I interviewed were companies with great brand names or advertising agencies that were going to help companies build those names.
Brad, did you have influence on getting the spokesperson, Mrs. Olson, to Folgers?
Her name was Virginia Christine, wonderful lady, and she was already the spokesperson when I joined the company, and for many years was the spokesperson after that. There was a lesson there, though. Those two brands, Maxwell House and Folgers, the blue can and the red can, one that started on the East Coast and one that started on the West Coast, which was the Folger coffee brand, started during the Gold Rush days, along with another little product called Levi's. This guy started cutting up pieces of canvas out of tents and making pants that would really last for the miners, the 49ers. and then another guy that went out there and started selling coffee. So the guy that started selling pants to the miners and coffee to the miners, they made a lot more money than the miners made. But the Folger coffee brand started on the West Coast in San Francisco and moved, you know, slowly east over its rollout. When I was there, we were still moving into the last 30-40% of the U.S. Maxwell House, on the other hand, started in the east. And those two brands, they went at each other in a kind of a negative way. If you may remember the early days of Mrs. Olson, she would end up in a kitchen and the wife would say something that seems pretty silly to us today, but, oh, my husband hates my coffee. What am I going to do? It's ruining our marriage. I can't make good coffee for my husband, which seems incredibly silly and quaint right now. But it was, and then she would say, well, you know, the coffee's either too bitter or something's wrong with it. And Mrs. Olson would save the day by pulling out a can of Folgers and saying, it's the richest, most aromatic kind, and it'll make a great cup of coffee. Meanwhile, you had Cora, a spokesperson for the Maxwell House brand on the East Coast, saying almost the same thing. She was in a country store, and she was this clerk behind the counter in a country store, and people would come in on vacation, and she would introduce them to this wonderful Maxwell House coffee because all the other coffees caused problems. So you had these two huge advertisers advertising all the problems that coffee could have. It was negative advertising. It was terrible. And the coffee category was declining and declining and declining. And finally, I can happily say I was part of the beginning of this. There was a whole turnaround in the idea of how to sell the coffee, and it moved to a new campaign called The Best Part of Waking Up is Folgers in Your Cup, and it was just positive. It wasn't negative about the other guy. It was positive about your own brand. And, you know, coffee consumption, as you know, in the last few years has been on the rise, and not in small part due to brands like Starbucks. But it was that's a good lesson, that it's better to just talk about the positives of your own product rather than the negatives, because when everybody's starting to talk about the negatives, the whole category went downhill. The message was coffee has problems, and guess what didn't have problems? You just pop the top on a soft drink, Coke, Pepsi, whatever, man. That's easy. You can't have a problem with that. So soft drinks were growing and coffee was declining, and due in some part to the advertising approaches that were being used.
Bridging over to storytelling, was there a particular storyteller in your family who taught you this art and science?
My family has lots of storytellers. I have my grandmother could tell stories. My father, who was a wonderful minister and preacher, could tell stories and told many stories. And I have an aunt. So I think our family is full of storytellers. And it's funny that you meant, I don't know where you got that, because it's not in my resume, and it's not, I don't know, somehow you gleaned that. But that's what I do. We tell stories in the movies we make now. For the Hallmark Hall of Fame, we're storytellers. And in the commercials within those movies, that are very unusual commercials. We only run 8 commercials in the whole 2 hours instead of about 50 or 60, and they're long, emotional commercials. So we're pretty well known for storytelling.
So obviously storytelling is in your DNA. Fusing that with your business acumen, how did you learn how to drink in the story? And then further to that, how did marketing Folgers prepare you for storytelling at Hallmark?
It's not the product itself. When I was at P&G, the favorite part of the job for me by far was doing the advertising. Hmm. Strangely enough, I also love package design, but the advertising itself and working with the creative people and the advertising agencies, we got to work with some of the very best people in the best advertising agencies. And, you know, that's what actually finally attracted me to the Hallmark position. When that finally started to occur, and I realized that, you know, what I would end up doing in a company that's structured very differently, I'd end up spending all my time doing the advertising. And then soon after I joined the company, I was given responsibility for this thing called the Hallmark Hall of Fame. which is, you know, full 2-hour movies that 4 and 5, 6 times a year, and getting to produce movies as well as commercials. For the first 15 years at TNG, I ran all the, at Hallmark, I ran all the advertising as well as the Hallmark Hall of Fame. And then I got to consult all around the world with our other subsidiaries in advertising for about 7 years. So I got to move to a company that I had tremendous admiration for, and a company who's very, you know, whose very purpose is to help enrich people's lives and help them express their love and their care for one another. And that's, it sounds corny, but that's exactly how we define our role at Hallmark. It's to enrich people's lives. And I got to move to a company like that and then to do the fulfill the functions that I instinctively like the most. So it wasn't really coffee so much as I really loved the process, the creative process of creating advertising.
So again, you connected emotionally with your consumer.
Yeah, it's true. And I did make comments about coffee itself, you know, being a pretty emotional product. But at P&G, one of the most important things you did when you developed advertising, and it's not just at P&G, agencies do this, there are books written about it. Instead of just talking about the benefit of a product or even the end benefit of the product, we would often talk about the end benefit with a hyphen. In other words, you know, you might have a benefit that it really gets some, you know, dirt out of your clothes in a particular way. And the benefit, therefore, is your clothes are clean. But the end benefit is that you feel really great as a mom or a dad when you do that. So what's the emotional benefit? It's the old benefit that you see when the drop bottle shot on Downy at the end of a commercial, Downy fabric softener, and the bottle would fall into slow motion into a pile of towels, and it would look like it just fell into a big pile of marshmallows. It was just so soft. Slow motion. But the real benefit was captured when a little girl ran up and jumped on her granddad's lap, and he wrapped her in his sweater, and it was a soft, good-smelling sweater. And so the real benefit was the human benefit. It always had to come back to what is the emotional benefit of a product. Sometimes that's a stretch for some brands to try to And an emotional benefit's not always syrupy and sappy. Sometimes it's pride. Look at the Nike brand and what the emotional benefits are in Nike and some other products like that. The emotional benefits of you know, Apple products. Those are very cool products, and you just feel really good when you're using them. So if you can advertise in such a way, communicate those benefits to people in such a way that you help them understand how that'll connect with them emotionally. That's the best power of advertising.
So to storytelling mechanics, how has the process evolved?
You know, for me, the mechanics of great storytelling is hire the very best writer. Get a great story idea and then hire the best writer. I don't pretend to be the person who knows how to do that. I sure know it when I see it. And I've been accused of doing an awful lot of editing and helping. But there's an art to a story. You have to introduce the characters. You have to care about the characters. Every so often we'll read a script and you sit down at the end of the script and you say, you know, I just don't care about those people. Well, that's not going to be a good movie. Even if it's an action adventure movie, even if it's a thriller, it doesn't have to necessarily be an emotional movie like we're known for. You have to care about the characters, and you think back on your favorite movies and you'll realize you cared about those characters. So you have to introduce the characters. You have to make people care about the characters. And same thing as writing a novel, writing a book. And you have to be able to relate somehow to some of those characters and then be with them and what they're going through or what they overcome.
So how has the art of storytelling actually changed?
I would say it has evolved to some degree. To a large degree. I think you have to engage the viewer more quickly. You have to keep the story moving more quickly. The pace has to be faster. And probably on television today with the kind of competition that's on television. When I started doing movies for Hallmark, there were three networks. Now you're competing with another 200 or 300, choices. And mm-hmm. so you really need to probably have the enjoyment factor a little higher. You can't just give people what you think is good for them. They're going to sit down and they're going to spend the evening and they want some enjoyment. And I hesitate to use the word entertainment because that sounds a little thin, but you want to not only entertain but also to inspire and to add and to have what our chairman calls constructive intent. The owner of Hallmark, it's a privately held company. The reason the Hallmark Hall of Fame has been on the air now for 60 years is the family that owns this company believes in it and wants to do it. The chairman of the board says, every movie we do has to have constructive intent. Doesn't mean it has to preach, but it needs to have good values in it. And that's why I say I have the best job there is. I've got wonderful resources. I work for a wonderful family. And my job is just to put out movies and commercials that have terrific constructive intent. So how do you go wrong with that?
Well, you really can't. How would you describe the end-in benefit for a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie, especially for a film like A Dog Named Christmas?
Well, it's not a commercial, so we're not actually trying to say there's an end-to-end benefit to something specific. What we were trying to do in that movie was to tell a wonderful story about, how this family's life was changed by helping, helping with this idea of adopting dogs at the holidays. And they take in this wonderful, dog that just, it's just a good heartwarming Christmas story, to be honest. And then we also turned it into a time where we, at the end of the broadcast, we said, you too can do this. And we partnered with some, with petfinders.com, and thousands and thousands of homeless pets were adopted or fostered over the holiday season. We think we actually started something completely new. The author, a guy named Greg Kincaid, who lives right here in Kansas City, turns out, right in the Kansas City area, wrote this book, and we got to know him pretty well in the process, did his book as the movie, and he came up with this idea. It was a new idea. And I'll just mention the movie we had before that, coming up right prior to Mother's Day in the same year, was called The Courageous Heart of Irena Sendler. And this is a true story of a woman who saved 2,500 children during the Holocaust in the Warsaw Ghetto. She smuggled these children out. She was beaten for it. She was truly a heroic person. She was a Roman Catholic pretty young woman, and she saw what was going on, and she became a social worker and a nurse, and would go in and out of the ghetto and talk these mothers and fathers into giving their children to her so she could smuggle them out, maybe so they would never see them again, promised that she wouldn't try to convert them. But so we went from an incredibly heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching story about the Holocaust. And the next movie was, just the title itself, A Dog Named Christmas. It's a bit lighter fare, but it also had some really great values in it. So it's really hard to compare them. And the movie we had before that was a love story. So, it's hard to categorize. You go from a love story to a tremendous story about a real person in a historical position in World War II, to a nice light story called A Dog Named Christmas, but with really great family values and values about taking care of these poor homeless pets.
Is it possible during our careers at Procter that no one ever said the two words constructive intent, but it existed?
I think it probably did. People ask me about the two companies from time to time, just in various conversations on college campuses or wherever it might be. And I've often said that the two companies that I've had the the privilege to work for, Procter & Gamble and Hallmark Cards, they have identical character. The character of the companies is the same. You know, what's right for people, what's right for employees, what's right for our consumers. But the companies have very different personalities. You know, Procter & Gamble, I haven't been there for 28 years, but I assume that it's still pretty buttoned up and somewhat military in its feel. I doubt if it's anywhere near what it used to be like that, but it was, you know, it's very, very buttoned up, very procedural, lots of procedures to go through. Hallmark is a family company. It's a big company, $4 to $5 billion a year in sales, but it's owned by one family, and it's a wonderful, wonderful family. Their name is Hall, and that's why the company's named Hallmark. So the personality of the company reflects, you know, their personality as well. I guess the other similarities in the companies would be, you know, the belief in the power of a strong brand or brands. And then, you know, let's always manage the business for the long term, which is maybe more remarkable for P&G than for Hallmark, because when you're a private company and you don't, you know, the shareholders sit around a dinner table at night. You know, they own the company. They can manage it for the long term. They don't have to worry about, you know, quarterly earnings. Procter & Gamble does. And still, I remember so distinctly how the company was managed for the long term. Decisions were made on what's right for the long term, not what's expedient today.
Now Brad, let's talk about today's frenzy culture and crazy consumer that's running 110 miles per hour. How will stories have to be shaped for that fast-moving group of people that can hardly stop to eat dinner?
That's a really good question. I can tell you people still love the Hallmark Hall of Fame series. We have some very, very loyal viewers. I think it's less about, you know, if you go back, despite what I said about pacing, you go back 40, 50, 60 years and you look at some great movies, they'll have, the pacing may be a little bit different, but the essence, you know, the principles of really good storytelling, they're the same, and I think they'll be the same, you know, certainly for the rest of my career and the next few generations. I think it's the delivery that we're having to keep up with. Young people today, they don't even subscribe to cable. They just subscribe to internet, and then they pick and choose what they're going to watch on the internet, on Hulu, or they'll download it one way or the other. That's a vast difference from one generation ago where you sat down in front of the TV set and you had three choices and you watched one of those three choices. And right now, I'm talking to you right now on an iPhone. And the iPhone has an incredible, you know, high definition screen. And when you hold it out at about as far away as your waist, that screen looks as big as a 50-inch high def screen across the room. You hold one and look at it and the proportions are the same to your eyes. You put it on an iPad or you put it on a laptop. And so people they're going to get their delivery of their programming, of their entertainment in completely different ways. When they want it, how they want it, on which device they want it. But to me, the storytelling, the content will remain more similar, but the delivery vehicles will just continue to evolve. And boy, are they evolving fast right now. They're just evolving at light speed right now.
Yeah, they want it now, where they want it, delivered for their convenience and entertainment.
And if it's good storytelling, that's an opportunity because now more people can see it. They've got more opportunities to see it and to find you if you're delivering something that's worthwhile for them.
Brad, let's sum this up with some final comments.
Boy, just that I've been fortunate to work for two wonderful companies. When I talk to college students, you know, the advice I give them is find something you really love to do. I'll refer back to, you know, that Patti Page song, Is That All There Is? You know, is that all there is to a career? Is it just finding something you love to do and doing it for a long time? And, you know, part of the that's part of the answer. It's, you better find something you love to do. You better find an organization that you respect and that you never have to question the values of that organization. So I've been really fortunate to be in two companies where I've never had to question the values of the people that are in positions of leadership. I'm in two companies where I've been in two companies where, you know, principle is what matters, not expedience. Where they invest in people, in their training and evaluating and mentoring of people. And then from a pure business standpoint, hey, keep your eye on the consumer, that's who we're here to serve. That's good. You know, there's one question you didn't ask me, which I was kind of expecting, and I had an answer for you about one of my best contributions at Procter & Gamble.
Please tell us.
When I left the company, my office used to be next to A.G. Laffley, and he and I were both associate advertising managers, and my phone rang about 2 weeks later, and he said, Brad, how did you leave? You got to tell me. I got to get out of here. I'm never going to make it here. So I'm too old. They're going to pass me up. And I said, A.G., they love you there. You need to stay there. Don't leave. And I'd love to take credit for helping to talk A.G. Laffley into staying there. I think I was one of 20 or 30 people that talked him into staying over the years of his career. He was a restless guy, but what a terrific guy.
Hey, Brad, thank you so much for being on our Success Made the Last show. You are truly a man of wisdom.
Thank you.
That was Brad Moore, my friend from Procter & Gamble and from Hallmark. We appreciate him being on today's show. And thanks to our sponsors, Gracefully Yours Greeting Cards, as well as Edward Jones Financial Advisors. Two great Midwest companies, by the way. I'm Rick Tocchini. We appreciate you being a part of this network family. And as we always say, may you live the best version of you. Have a great week. And then run the new Graceful Years commercial and the old Edward Jones commercial as the outro. Cut on that. Graceful Years is America's favorite encouragement greeting card company. When you need encouragement, prayers, thank you, and oh yeah, to celebrate events like birthdays and anniversaries, this is the greatest greeting card company around. You can get it all at gracefully-yours.com today. And you know, while you spend $3 to $4 per individual card that you may buy at a Walmart, a Walgreens, a CVS, a Cost Plus World Market, and maybe even buying cards for $1 or $1.50 at dollar stores, Graceful Years cards can be purchased in their artsy collection of 12 cards. This is their box cards. That'll cost you less than 75 cents per card. And top it off with, those are delivered to your home, your office, your church, your company, wherever, with free shipping. You just can't beat the quality, the value. There are 50-some-odd wonderful fine artists that are all a part of the Gracefully Yours collection. So support Gracefully Yours today. Go to gracefully-yours.com today and support that company. And if you want to get your cards at an extra discount through Success Made to Last, you can put in the promotion code BOOK3 today. That's B-O-O-K-3 and get 25% off your total purchase. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine at edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.